This is Nick Treadwell, and you are listening to Nick Treadwell's Storyville. Chapter 8. He was not to sleep for long.
Remo, how do you make this thing let you talk to Smith?
Remo opened an eye. Cheyenne was pointing a long index finger at the telephone. His finger quivered, as if personally enraged at the thought of having to use the instrument. The finger contained all the outrage in the world, as if it were trying to shame an ant which had just climbed into the noodle salad.
"At this hour?" Remo said sleepily.
"You going to start negotiating a new contract? Because tigers aren't covered under your old one?"
"We are not amused at your feeble attempts to be funny. How?"
"It's very easy," said Remo thickly, sleep still fuzzing his brain.
"What day of the week is this?"
"Tuesday, Wednesday, the way you name them, who knows?" Remo said.
"Well, you've got to know before you can call Smith. That's the key to the whole dippy system."
"All right, it is Wednesday."
"And does this month have an R in it?" asked Remo.
"May does not have an R in it, so how do I call Smith?"
"Well, as long as this is Wednesday and the month doesn't have an R in it, you just dial the 800 area code, then the first 7 digits of my old army serial number. If it had an R in it, you'd have to look in the Wall Street Journal for the total number of shares traded on the big board and dial the first 7 numbers of that."
"What is this board that has shares?" asked Cheyenne.
"The big board? That's the New York Stock Exchange."
"Why did they pick that? They are truly lunatics."
"Ah," said Remo. "Now you're falling into the trap I always fall into. Instead of just doing it and making the call, I always wonder why they picked the New York Stock Exchange and not the AMEX or Chicago Options Board. I get to wondering about things like that, and before you know it, I forget the code, or it's after midnight and the code has changed to something else and I don't remember it. Smith says that this is the product of a restless mind."
"Smith is wrong as usual," said Cheyenne. "It is the product of no mind at all. This is Wednesday in May without an R. So, how do I talk to Smith?"
"I told you, dial 800 and then the first 7 digits of my old army serial number."
"And that is?"
"Now you know why I never call Smitty on Wednesday. I don't remember my old army serial number. Call him tomorrow."
"Tomorrow may be too late," Cheyenne said softly.
But Remo wasn't listening. He had turned to the wall and sleep enveloped him like a fast-breathing wave. He slept with heavy, labored breaths. To Cheyenne, for whom breathing was the secret key to the art and science of Sin and Jew, the noisy gasps told him how far Remo had slipped because of his injuries and how far he would have to come to return to a normal condition. If he had the time. He lifted the telephone and dialed 0 for operator. Dr. Harold W. Smith had spent the night in his office reading the latest reports from Boston. There could no longer be any doubt. Dr. Sheila Feinberg had created more of the very same creatures she had become. The rising toll of deaths proved that, separated by distance but not by name, they were the work of more than one. Now, in a population where wits had already been scrambled by fright, there would be worse outcry with the mysterious deaths of James Hallahan, the assistant FBI director of Boston. A house had burned, and in the charred ruins, firemen found the bodies of two persons. In the backyard, Hallahan's body was found. He may have been tracking the tiger people, been discovered, and fell off the roof while trying to flee. But why hadn't he been wearing shoes? Still no word from Remo and Cheyenne. The days dragged. Smith was being forced to face the prospect that his two strongest weapons, Remo and Cheyenne, had gotten in the way of the tiger people and been eaten? Could it be Remo and Cheyenne? A meal for someone? Harold W. Smith allowed no antic thoughts to cross his mind and disrupt his usual pattern of precise logical thinking. But he could not block out the picture of Remo and Cheyenne on a platter, lying on a table, surrounded by people drooling with anticipation. Smith laughed. In that brief, fleeting, uncharacteristic act, Smith finally came to understand something he had never before allowed himself to consider. He did not believe that Remo was the reincarnation of Shiva. That was a fairy tale of Cheyenne's. But he now knew he believed Remo and Cheyenne were indestructible. These two very real, very human people had stood for Smith and for cure against diseases, nuclear weapons, the forces of the universe, gunmen, arsenals, and electronic devices. They had always prevailed and would prevail again. If they didn't, then no one could. The human race was doomed, and no amount of worrying would change that fact. So Harold Smith discarded worry for perhaps the first time in his adult life and laughed again, aloud. His secretary, hearing the strange sound, thought Smith was choking and came running into the room.
"Are you all right, doctor?"
"Yes, Miss Purvish," Smith said and snickered.
Oh, I'm fine and everything's going to be all right. Don't you think so?"
His secretary nodded and made a mental note. She would have to report Smith's unusual behavior to the person at the National Foundation for Scientific Research, who paid her to telephone every month and report on Dr. Smith's mental health. She had never met the person and never knew why anyone would think it was worth $100 a month to know the state of Smith's mind. But she liked the $100. If she had been told the truth that Smith himself paid her that money, she would not have believed it. But that was the way Cure operated. With thousands of people passing along tips to the FBI, the Agriculture Department, the Immigration Service, the Customs Bureau, pouring them all into a pipeline that carried information, and at the end of the pipeline, watching all the reports, were Cure's computers and Harold W. Smith, checking everything. But who checked the checker? Early on, Smith had realized the almost absolute and unbridled power of his position could be enough to distort a man's logical judgment. If he suffered from an error in judgment, would he be able to tell? Impaired judgment might make it impossible to recognize impaired judgment. So he devised the simple idea of having Miss Purvish pass along regular reports on his attitude and behavior. The reports bypassed the National Foundation of Scientific Research and went directly to Smith, who had an opportunity generally unknown in a large organization, the chance to see what his secretary really thought of him.
For 10 years, she thought he was perfectly normal. Normal being unemotional, penny-pinching, and totally devoid of a sense of humor. 10 years, 520 reports, reading subject perfectly normal. He knew what the next report would read. Subject laughed. Strange, unheard of behavior. The fact that laughter was unheard of behavior for Harold Smith struck him as so funny he laughed again and kept laughing until Miss Purvis buzzed him on the intercom.
Sorry to bother you with this, doctor, but there is a phone call I can't make heads or tails of. I think it's for you.
Yes?
As near as I can tell, we have 14 telephone operators on the line at once, along with somebody speaking a language I can't understand. Everybody seems to be trying to reach some kind of emperor named Smith, because if they don't, they're going to be killed. I really don't understand it, sir.
Smith giggled.
Neither do I, he lied. But I'll take it. I need a good laugh. Yes, sir. I guess so, sir, she said.
Another item for her report on Harold Smith's rapidly deteriorating mental condition. Hello, he said, and was deluged with a gabbling gaggle of operators all talking at once. He could not understand a single word until he heard a regal roar.
Silence, cackling hens. Remove yourself from my hearing.
It was Chan's voice. Like clicking a switch, the line cleared and he and Smith could talk uninterrupted. Smith pressed a button that made it impossible for Miss Purvis to listen in.
Hello? Smith said.
Greetings to the Emperor from the Master of Sin and Ju, said Chan.
Are you all right? Smith asked. Remo?
I am well as ever. Remo is not.
What's wrong?
He has been injured by one of those people beasts. We must return to Fulcroft.
No, Smith said quickly.
That's too dangerous. We can't do that. Last night they attacked and tried to kill us. Soon they may succeed. We must be gone from this city of beans and people who do not know how to speak.
Last night, said Smith, was that the building where there was the fire?
Yes.
There was a body found in the yard, an FBI man, Hallahan. Do you know what happened to him?
Yes, I removed him.
Smith felt a sinking feeling in his stomach.
Why? He asked.
He was one of them, Chayan said. They are now many.
Oh.
We must return to Fulcroft where Remo can be safe.
Where are you now? Smith asked.
In a hotel you drive to, Chayan said.
A motel. How'd you get there?
By a taxicab driven by a driver who mercifully did not speak once.
They'll find you then, Smith said. The cab driver will remember both of you.
Yes, we must return to Fulcroft. If that is forbidden, we will leave the country, never to return.
No, all right, Smith said. He gave Chayan elaborate plans on taking a taxi to one of the entrances of the Massachusetts Turnpike and there transferring to a rented limousine. That rented limousine from Boston would be met on the road by another rented limousine from Connecticut, which would finish the trip to Fulcroft.
Did you understand all that?
Yes, Chayan said. One more thing, Emperor, but so small as almost not to trouble you over.
What is that?
Who is going to pay for all these cabs and limousines?
I will, Smith said.
Do I have to advance the drivers the money? Asked Chayan.
It would be helpful.
I will get it back from you?
asked Chayan.
Yes.
I will get receipts, Chayan said and hung up. Smith replaced the telephone. He no longer felt like laughing.